This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women right around you who have done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom. In some cases, they've survived against incredible odds, and that's the kind of story we're going to hear this time. If you're by a computer or even a smartphone, pull up YouTube, because there is a video you're absolutely going to want to see. Our guest today is 91-year-old Dick Say of Vista, California, originally from Pasadena. And what was life like growing up in Southern California in the 1930s? I imagine it was a little less crowded than it is now.
Very much so. I'm thinking my formative years, I lived on, my father had a little one-acre ranch, raised chickens, and got through the Depression. That way, the Depression was always something we were worried about. Money didn't come easily. I had a good time. I enjoyed those years. I was a curious kid. I managed to be able to entertain myself. I was a little bit on the shy side, so I didn't have a whole lot of friends. But I enjoyed it. It was an interesting time. I didn't know we were poor. I didn't know that the mortgage was due and we were going to have a hard time paying it. Getting through school, didn't like school at all. I hated school, so so I couldn't wait to get home to make my model airplanes, read, play with things, do strange things, unbelievable things I would try to do.
You mentioned model airplanes. Was flying something that fascinated you at an early age?
I would say yes. I didn't have a great interest in flying, but yes, I was. It was a mechanical process, a mechanical thing, and I was interested in most anything mechanical. I love science. Yeah, I would say that from the time I was 10 on up, I had an interest in aircraft.
I ask every veteran this question because everybody seems to have a pretty good answer, and I sure get a whole lot of different pictures, a pretty good mosaic of where different people were and how they found out. Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Absolutely. Sunday morning in Long Beach, I had driven from El Monte to my girlfriend's house in Long Beach. And
I thought you said you didn't date.
Well, I'm older now. I mean, we skipped a year or two out of high school. I can tell you the weather. It was a nice, bright, sunny day. Sitting in my girlfriend's living room, her brothers were there, and I think her father was there. We was listening to the news or listening to the radio. I don't think even the news was on. And we heard the broadcast being interrupted about something happened in Pearl Harbor. None of us had a slightest idea where Pearl Harbor was. But the only thing, just because of the tone of the announcer, we knew it was bad. From that hour on, that whole day, we were all stuck right on the radio. And then we finally found out where Pearl Harbor was and what happened. I mean, pieces and parts of it. So that's how I heard about Pearl Harbor.
Did you have any clue at that point that it was going to make a difference in your life?
Well, yes. I was 17. I believe the draft had started. They had started the draft, so I knew, well, I'm pretty ripe. And I didn't have to worry about it yet because they hadn't insisted I register. So, yeah, I knew it would have an effect on us, and we better start thinking about something like that. And in fact, as I thought, well, I think I better go back to school, kind of brush up in case I want to do something other than get into the infantry. So I went to Long Beach Junior College and tried to brush up on my math and my science studies and things like that.
And how was it that you ended up in the Army Air Corps? That was a decision you made yourself?
Oh, yes. I knew the draft was on my tail. That if I was drafted, I would go into the Army, and it would be definitely the infantry, and I couldn't see myself wallowing around in the mud, and I didn't want to be a Marine. That was just a little too macho, and the Navy didn't interest me at all, so I thought, gee, the Air Corps, besides, they had a very good theme. told my dad, it says, he asked me, well, have you made any plans? Are you thinking about? And I says, yeah, I'm going to join the Air Corps. And he kind of laughed at me and says, Dick, you're wasting your time. I mean, first of all, you need a college degree. And I didn't have that. I just barely got through high school. He says, you're underweight. You'll never pass a physical. My father wasn't exactly somebody that was very positive about things. And he, but I thought at the time, I said, well, wait a minute. Maybe I'll just show you. So I went into a recruiting house. It wasn't a station. It was a house in Los Angeles. And the first thing they did was told us to strip. And a gang of us all in a line stripped down to our skivvies. And you, and you out. And I was one of the yous. Underweight. They knew I was underweight. They says, come back if you can gain 8 or 10 pounds.
How much did you weigh?
I probably weighed 160. I was 6'2". Skinny as a rail. You blow away. I could blow away in a good breeze. And went home, feasted on bananas and milk and anything else I could get down, and brought my weight up. Passed the physical. Now I'm in line for the mental or the IQ. Far from prepared for this, believe you me. And you talk about a comedy of errors. I'm a result of one of those. The IQ test was taken at the same place. Turned it in. I had a score, I think, of 90-something. That wasn't good enough. The score had to be 100. So I'm out. I thought, okay, that's it. About a week, 10 days later, I got a notice in the mail saying that they had given us the wrong test. The test that I should have taken would have passed at 90. I'm back in again. I have now, all I have to do is wait for the president to say you have been accepted in the Army Air Corps. You are now a cadet in waiting. Those of us who are waiting, every night we go down to the local drive-in. Has your order come? Has your order come? Has anything happened? Have you heard anything? Finally, my order came. You are now assigned to Santa Ana. You to report to Santa Ana, California for basic training at a such and such a date. That's it. I am now an aviation cadet, the lowest person in the U.S. Army. There's no one lower than a cadet. You're not even called sergeant or anything. You are a mister. Took the red car, the Pacific Electric car, to from El Monte to Santa Ana, and got my first indoctrination of Army life. Got the flu. And one of the first things I better learn was to say, sir.
What happened if you didn't?
I can't use the words that they that would happen. You would be hazed, put on duty, KP duty, a whole bunch of things like that. Or you could even be washed out. You have to have your 20/15 eyesight. You have to have the hearing. You have to have. You can't be colorblind. You can't be this. You got to be that. Your blood pressure has to be so and so. You have to be so high. You can't be too high. I went in to see the psychiatrist. You have to take a psychiatric test. And he says, don't you ever say sir when an officer talks to you? And I said, oh boy, I'm in trouble. So the first thing that came to my mind, I says, well, I've got an awful lot to learn, don't I? And apparently that satisfied him.
You talk about people potentially washing out for not saying sir. There are a lot of other reasons they'd wash out. And most of the Army Air Corps veterans that I meet, whether they were bombers or, bombardiers or navigators or gunners or whatever, they went in hoping to become a pilot like you eventually did. Were there any points along the way of that training where you thought, you know what, I might not make it as a pilot?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, you can't believe. Hourly. Literally hourly. It was always that right on the cusp. Today I'm going to wash out. Well, for example, in Santa Ana, which is basic training, you don't even see an airplane. You don't. but you're constantly in school. There's math questions and things like that. Well, there's code, there's radio, there's meteorology, there's engines, there's aerodynamics, all these things. They're testing you on these constantly, and you've got to pass these tests, any one of them. Aircraft identification, you can flunk on that and be washed out. So you've got that fear, that constant fear.
What do you think it was that helped you get through all that and actually get your wings?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess fear of failure, just a horrible fear of failure. And where will I go if they wash me out? I'll go back to the inventory. You could be a radio man. You could be a mechanic. That wouldn't be acceptable. That just wouldn't be acceptable. I wanted to be a pilot.
I want to talk to you about the B-25. And before I get to your own personal experience in it, obviously the signature B-25 moment was the Doolittle raid on Tokyo. Is that something that you heard about when it happened?
Yes, I heard about it like everyone else. I was amazed that they were able to do that. I didn't think the airplane would be capable of taking off of the deck of a carrier.
Do you remember the first time you flew a B-25, what it felt like? Did you think it was a good airplane right off the bat?
The first time I flew it was in Lahana, Colorado. I wasn't really horribly impressed with it, only because they were worn out old things. The brakes didn't work properly, and it was so cold that you couldn't touch anything metal. And so my first impression of a B-25 was not so much the plane itself, it was just the conditions around it. But I did learn in a very short time that it was a good aircraft. And I'm very thankful that's what I was flying when I had my mishap.
Yeah, maybe you wouldn't be here if it had been a different plane.
No, there's no, I can't think of any other airplane would have taken the beating that mine took and stayed in the air and stayed together when we hit the water.
Yeah, this is an incredible story we're going to hear. Before we get to that, I know that was your 13th mission, so there were a dozen before that. And for people that aren't familiar with a B-25, how many people were in your crew, and what kind of sense of responsibility did that give you as the leader of that plane?
Six-man crew, pilot, co-pilot, bombardier, and navigator, waist gunner, tail gunner, flight engineer. My responsibility was to fly the airplane. I had one heck of a good crew. I trusted my crew. I had an engineer. If he said it was ready to fly, I probably trusted him more than he trusted me. A radio man, Hunt, good dedicated kids. They were as much responsible for the safety and the condition of the aircraft as more than I was. So I flew the airplane.
And you called them kids. You were all of 22?
Yeah, I was old, probably 6-18 months older. The old man.
You went overseas with the 38th Bomb Group, the 822nd Squadron. What kind of missions did you guys fly? And do you remember some close calls in those first 12 missions?
Yes, there were. The nice thing about the type of flying we were doing compared to, we'll say, the high-level bombing that the heavies were doing, the B-24s and the 17s, we were only over the target for just a matter of almost seconds. You would come in at an extremely low altitude, 50 feet and under, hit your target, and you're out of there. And the only thing you have to worry about would be maybe a fighter, a Zero or something like that, that happened to catch up with you. If that happened, and I think it did happen a couple of times, but I didn't even know it. I was so concentrated on the tight formation that we relied on for safety. If a fighter came within 200 yards of me, I probably wouldn't have seen it unless its rounds were actually hitting me or something like that. We flew at very, very tight formation, and we flew these formations at low levels. So you were concentrated on the plane next to you. You were just absolute concentrated. It never took your eye off of it.
Did you feel that this was dangerous duty? Were you scared? Were you concerned?
No, not scared. Too much is happening. You're probably scared, worried just before you go in. Maybe at the briefing is your worst time, when they're telling you what could happen. That may be a stressful time. But actually, once you're on a run, nothing exists outside of that cockpit and what's exactly ahead of you. See, this B-25 we have, it's a flying machine gun. We have 18 machine guns on it, most of them firing forward. Once you hit the trigger button, you get 8, 10, 12 machine guns firing within 6 or 8 feet of you. The world ends. I mean, you are concentrating on only one thing, keeping that airplane in the air and where you're headed. All hell breaks loose for about 60 seconds, and then it's over. Compared to being a B-17 pilot in the Air Force, where you're under any aircraft fire for 4 to 5 hours, I can't believe that the guys just didn't go completely mad doing that kind of work.
Well, I'm pretty sure they'd be blown away by the story you're going to share, but it's break time. Back with the incredible details of how the war ended for 91-year-old Dick Say 70 years ago, and the almost unbelievable way the most recent chapter unfolded just in the past year. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.